Chapter 48. Hickman had no trepidations about being a non-Muslim inside Mecca. He hated the Islamic religion and all it stood for. After meeting with the dozen Indian nationals in the house in Riyadh at 4 p.m. and briefing them, they set out on the 10-hour drive to Mecca and the Kaaba in a stolen panel van marked with Islamic writing that read Kingdom Cleaning on the side. They were dressed in long white flowing garments, and each had a broom, bucket, putty knife, and brushes. Hickman had paid a forger to write a letter in Arabic explaining that they were here to remove any chewing gum found on the grounds. Inside a bright yellow plastic janitor's cart, behind a white canvas curtain, Hickman had placed both the meteorite and some aerosol cans that Vanderwald had sent in his latest shipment. Each of the Hindus had a molded hunk of C6 explosive with a tiny timer duct-taped to the small of his back. On each of their legs, hidden under the robes they wore, was a handgun, just in case things went bad. The van pulled up to a gate leading into the vast mosque. Hickman and the others climbed out, pulled out the cart, buckets, and brooms, and then walked toward the guard. Hickman had trained for this tirelessly, learning both Arabic and how to read body language. He handed over the sheet of paper and then spoke. "In the name of merciful Allah, we come to clean the holy site," he said. The time was late, the guard was tired, and the mosque was closed. There was little reason for him to believe the men were anything other than what they said they were. He waved them through without comment. Wheeling the cart in front of him, Hickman pushed it under an arched passageway that led to the interior of the shrine. Once inside the passageway, Hickman slipped a small mask and filter over his mouth and nose, then wrapped his headdress over that so only his eyes showed. Motioning to the Hindus to spread out and place the charges around the perimeter, he headed directly toward the Kaaba. Four tall men in ceremonial uniforms were walking guard on each corner. Every 5 minutes, they walked from the corner outside the black shroud, with exaggerated steps that raised their feet in the air like beefeaters at Buckingham Palace. Each guard moved from the corner where he was standing to the next in a clockwise direction, then stopped and waited. They were just finishing a repositioning when Hickman wheeled close with the cart. Reaching into the cart, he popped one of the aerosol cans to open, then pushed it near the guard. The guard remained motionless for a second, then dropped to his knees, onto his chest, and finally face down on the marble floor. Hickman quickly slipped under the curtain with the cart and pushed it inside. Then he ran over to Abraham's stone and pried it from the silver frame with a short iron rod he had hidden in the cart. Quickly switching it with the meteorite from Greenland, he placed Abraham's stone under the white canvas curtain around the janitor's cart. He then hid explosive charges around the perimeter and slipped back under the shroud. Vanderwald had explained that the knockout gas he had supplied only had effects for between 3 and 4 minutes. After that time, anyone who had breathed the gas would start to come around. Hickman pushed the cart toward the arched passageway. The Hindus worked quickly. The 6 assigned pillars closest to the passageway were already waiting in the tunnel. 2 more arrived a few minutes later, then 2 more. Hickman watched as the last pair hurried across the large expanse of marble. Followed by the Hindus, Hickman pushed the cart past the guard at the entrance.
"What are you doing?" the guard asked.
"A 1,000 apologies," Hickman said in Arabic, still pushing the cart toward the van. "They told us inside we are supposed to clean tomorrow night."
Hickman and the others piled into the van and were just pulling away when the guard awoke. Shifting around until he was sitting on the marble, the guard glanced about to see if anyone had noticed. Apparently no one had. The guard on the other corner was facing away, as ceremony dictated. He rose to his feet and stared at his watch. 1:30 until the change. The guard decided to keep the fact he had passed out a secret. He knew if he told anyone, they would replace him before the Hajj. The guard had dreamed his entire life of being a ceremonial guard. A slight case of heat stroke or food poisoning would not end his dream. Hickman directed the driver to the road that led to the town of Rabigh on the Red Sea. Once there, the Hindus would hide out in a house he had rented. Tomorrow night they would drive to Medina. Hickman would not spend the night in Rabigh. A boat was waiting for him at the port. By first light, he would be on board and steaming north. Overholt was sitting in the Oval Office. He finished his briefing and sat back in his chair. "This is one hell of a mess, Langston," the president said. Overholt nodded slowly. "Our relationship with Saudi Arabia is at an all-time low," the president continued. "Ever since Senator Grant passed the bill condemning the kingdom for being home to the September 11th hijackers and Congress passed the special tax on Saudi crude oil, our diplomats have hardly been able to even arrange meetings. The latest polls show a majority of the U.S. citizens think we should have attacked Saudi Arabia and not Iraq. And now you tell me that a crazy American billionaire is planning to strike at the country's holiest sites."
"I know it's a powder keg, Mr. President."
"Powder keg?" the president exploded. "It's much worse than that. If Hickman has poisoned prayer rugs and switched Abraham's stone and something like you theorize happens to it, I see three major things that could happen. The first is a given. The Saudis cut off oil shipments to the U.S. That'll plunge us into another recession, and we're barely out of the last one. That would be a shock that our economy just could not stand. Second, the fact that Hickman is an American will fan the flames with the terrorist elements. They will be swimming to the U.S. to wreak havoc. Let's face it, the U.S.-Canadian and U.S.-Mexican borders are sieves. Short of us erecting walls, there's not much we can do if someone's determined to enter our country. The third is possibly the worst. If the Greenland meteorite is shattered and releases a virus similar to the one that was in the Arizona sample, then the other two might be moot points. The oxygen could be sucked out of the atmosphere like water down a drain. Then we'll all be breathing dust."
Overholt nodded slowly.
"The first two are easily handled if what the CIA doctor learned from the captured combatant is true. That Hickman is planning to blame the entire affair on the Israelis."
"Unfortunately, as much as I've tried to wean the Israelis from American aid, I've been mostly unsuccessful. The Arab world believes the United States and Israel are closely tied, and we are. If the blame goes to Israel, it would be overrun with Arab troops from any nation that has troops, and we know what would happen then."
"The Israelis would go nuclear," Overholt said.
"So, what are we left with?" the president asked. "Give me the out."
"The only way we can put this thing to bed is to eliminate the prayer rugs, capture Hickman, and somehow replace the meteorites if he has already switched them, then search the holy sites for explosives."
"All without the Saudi Arabian government knowing what we're doing," the president said. "That's a tall order."
"Mr. President," Overholt said, "do you have a better idea?"
On January 4th, 2006, at 5 a.m. Qatar time, the telephone in Cabrillo's hotel room rang and woke him.
"It's me, Juan," Overholt said. "I've finished meeting with the president and have your orders."
Cabrillo sat up in bed. "What's the verdict?"
"He wants to do it all without Saudi cooperation," Overholt said. "I'm sorry, but that's the only way we see this working."
Cabrillo exhaled and the sound carried over the telephone line. "We have 6 days until the Hajj, when 2 million pilgrims will be all over Mecca and Medina, and you want me to send a team inside for what?"
"First, you find Hickman,"
Overholt said,
"and determine the status of the meteorite. If he has switched it with Abraham's stone, you switch it back. Then, you search Al-Haram and Al-Nabawi mosques, and make sure they're not wired to blow during the Hajj. Then, you and your team get out of Saudi Arabia before anyone knows you're there.
I hate to talk business when you are talking fantasy, Cabrillo said, but do you have any idea what this is going to cost the United States?
8 figures,
Overholt guessed. Maybe 9, Cabrillo said.
So you can do it?
Maybe, but I'll need all the resources of the Department of Defense and the entire intelligence community on our side.
You call,
Overholt said.
I'll make sure they jump.
Cabrillo hung up and dialed a number. An hour later, while Cabrillo was still back at the hotel showering, Holly Kasim walked out onto a runway in front of a hangar on the edge of the U.S. Air Force Base in Qatar. 37 men were milling about, the entire number of Muslim U.S. military men from Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean to the continent of Africa. All had been flown in yesterday from their various postings on military jets to Qatar. Not one man had been told why they were sent for.
Gentlemen, Kasim said, form ranks.
The men lined up and waited at parade rest. Kasim studied a sheet of paper. He looked up and addressed the men.
My name is Holly Kasim. I served 7 years in the United States Navy as a warrant officer, W-4, in underwater demolition before joining the private sector. I have been recalled to active duty by presidential decree and given a field rank of commander for the purposes of this operation. According to my docket, the next highest-ranking man here is a United States Air Force captain named William Scudder. Would Captain Scudder please step forward?
A tall, thin, black man dressed in a blue Air Force uniform took 2 steps forward.
Captain Scudder, Kasim said, is my second in command. Please, come over here next to me and face the troops.
Scudder walked over and pivoted on his heel and stood alongside Kasim.
Captain Scudder will be dividing you into teams according to your various service ranks in the next few hours, Kasim said. Right now, I want to explain why each of you was selected to appear here today. First and foremost, all of you are United States military personnel. Secondary, and very important to this mission, each of you listed Islam as your religion on your military records. Is there anyone here who is now not a Muslim? If there are, please step forward.
No one moved.
Very good, gentlemen, Kasim said. We have a special operation we need you for. If you could follow me into the hangar, we have assembled chairs and a briefing area. Once you are all seated, I will begin to explain.
Kasim, followed by Scudder, walked toward the hangar. The men filed behind. There was a series of blackboards surrounding a podium, several long folding tables with various weapons and devices displayed, a water cooler, and several rows of black plastic folding chairs. The men filed into their seats as Kasim and Scudder walked to the front.